It's a Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up this hour, we'll talk with a New York Times reporter who's journeying north along I-35. He'll eventually get to Iowa, and we'll find out what his mission is. Also, Marshalltown native actor Toby Huss will tell us about his new series on AMC. It premieres this Sunday, and toward the end of the program, we'll remember Maya Angelou. I spoke with her in 2009. We'll go back to that and hear a clip from that. But before that, we'll also hear about a shortage of court reporters, what's being done there. Politics in just a moment with one of our regular political commentators, analyst and political scientist Tim Hagel will be along. But before that, earlier today, we just heard in our news, President Obama accepted the resignation of Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki. This comes just hours after the beleaguered retired general apologized and accepted the responsibility for the health care scandal that has turned his agency into a political war zone. And joining us now to talk about this scandal and perhaps how Iowa may fit in, Tony Lays is a health reporter for the Des Moines Register. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Ben.
Let's talk first about the breaking news, Shinseki resigning. What do you think this means?
Well, I would have been surprised if he could have hung on, given the level of controversy. But this problem existed when he took the job, and it's not going to go away just because one person was forced to quit.
Mm-hmm. So, national scandal buffeting the Department of Veterans Affairs, reports of long waiting lists leading to even patient deaths, controversy sparked by reports that the VA staff hid the fact that about 40 veterans died while waiting for appointments at the agency's Phoenix Hospital. Of course, we here in Iowa wondering with our veterans facilities here, any indication that what happened in Phoenix has happened in Iowa?
We haven't seen any indication that it has.
Okay, nothing at all. But nevertheless, in response to the scandal, the Veterans Affairs Agency is reviewing all of its 1,700 hospitals across the country, hospitals and clinics, and recently released a list of incidents where something interfered with the care of a veteran. The VA in Iowa City appears on that list?
It does. Mm-hmm. There was an incident, a death apparently last year of a veteran. The report, frankly, is not very clear on what these numbers mean. And I talked to the spokesman at the Iowa City VA, and what he said is they ended up on that list because they looked into whether a delay in care caused this death, which apparently was a cancer death. And what they determined was there was a delay, but it was the patient who delayed calling for an appointment who put off going to the doctor until the disease had progressed, and he did wind up dying.
Mm-hmm. What about waiting times across the country and specifically here in Iowa? What have you found out about that?
Well, there are waiting times here. What I've heard for years about the VA is the main frustration I hear from veterans is how long it takes to get in as opposed to the quality of the care. In general, I hear they feel pretty good about the quality of the care. It just can take a while to get in. It really seems to vary by what kind of appointment you're trying to get, and it seems to go up and down with time. But it certainly is a long-standing issue that they've had there.
Mm-hmm. And as a health reporter for the Des Moines Register, this is nothing new to you, hearing about this, right?
No. I mean, what's interesting about this is I think a journalism professor could do a pretty good study of how a media storm comes to pass, because there have been stories for years about this issue. I did a big Sunday story a couple of years ago about a Marine vet from Greenfield who'd been waiting for 2 years to get the VA to tell him how much of a disability payment he was due, and that's a related issue. This has suddenly gotten a lot of traction. I hope it doesn't just disappear when a few people get fired for covering it up, because it feels like a lot of the anger is about the cover-up, and rightly so. But I think the bigger issue is that people have died here.
Mm-hmm. Moving forward, what do you see? What will this investigation mean for us specifically in Iowa and also with the other hospitals and clinics?
I think it might end up increasing pressure for the VA to loosen up its rules on when veterans can use their VA benefits to get care at private hospitals and clinics. There already are times when they let them do that, but there has been talk for years that they ought to transition the system away from having government-owned hospitals and government-employed doctors and instead have it be more like an insurance card like Medicare, where you could take it to your local hospital. You wouldn't have to travel so far. And you know, if there's a big waiting list at one facility, you could check another facility, a private facility, to see if you could get in quicker. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes.
We'll maybe check back with you. Tony Lay is a health reporter for the Des Moines Register. Thank you for the update.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Let's talk politics now to discuss a couple of political developments late in this week. Tim Hagel is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Hi, Tim.
Hey there.
A couple of other things we want to talk about, but let's talk about the Shinseki resignation. What is your view on that?
Well, I agree with what Tony was saying, is that maybe it's important for Shinseki to have resigned just because he's the focus point at this particular point, and if he's out of the way, then maybe they can focus on the problem. But the problem is more deep rooted, and so they're going to have to kind of dig in and find out what the specifics were. And in fact, the fact that Shinseki is not there now could actually slow it down a little bit, because the new person, Sloan, and I've forgotten his last name, starts with a G, Gibson maybe, he's been there for a while, but there's going to be a learning curve as he moves up to the next level, and they're looking for a new secretary, and sometimes that just puts everybody on hold for a while. And so it may be that things aren't going to move as quickly as maybe they could have if Shinseki had stayed.
What signs do you see that this has turned into, or may even increasingly become, a political football in Washington?
Well, I don't know so much that it's a political football, because you did have a number of Democrats that were coming forward also calling for Shinseki to resign or be removed, that they're concerned about this as well. Now, some people were noticing that it seemed to be Democrats that were in tough races potentially for the fall that were coming forward, but I don't think that you're going to have quite as much partisan bickering over this type of issue, although it will depend on what the specific recommendations are as to whether you might have a little bit more of that political back and forth.
Let's talk about some action in the U.S. House of Representatives yesterday. The House Republicans they voted 218 to 193, largely along party lines, to pass an amendment sponsored by Iowa Congressman, U.S. Congressman Steve King, an amendment attached to a bill funding commerce. And this amendment attached would have the Justice and State Departments providing them $5 million for the Department of Justice to investigate the release of immigrants, some with criminal charges or convictions, by the Department of Homeland Security. Explain what's going on there. What do you see?
Well, there are a couple of things. The first is an issue that's hit the news in the last couple of weeks, something of that nature, where it was learned that DHS had been releasing people. Now, we knew that they had been releasing kind of a catch-and-release sort of thing with illegal immigrants for some time, but now it comes out that some of the people released were people that had actually been committed or convicted of serious offenses, felonies, and so forth. And that's sort of a different thing than somebody who, okay, maybe you violated immigration laws, maybe, you know, traffic tickets or something like that. Well, we aren't going to keep you for that. Just let you go. Well, apparently they've been letting people go for more serious crimes as well, and some of these folks have committed additional crimes, and so that becomes a problem. And so this is an attempt to sort of deal with that particular aspect of it. Of course, it comes in the context of the broader immigration issues. And interestingly, it's similar to the VA situation, where you have an underlying problem that hasn't gotten much traction. Illegal immigration in one case, the waiting times in the VA in another, and it's not until there's some sort of different aspect to it that gets people's attention, whether it's the fact that people died or there was a cover-up in the VA, or here that people were being released with the felonies, that all of a sudden you get to focus attention on it. We'll have to see what, if anything, comes of it, but now people are at least paying more attention.
What are the chances of Congress agreeing on any meaningful immigration reform before the November election? You're going to laugh at me, right?
Probably not a lot. It's one of those things where this is an issue where Democrats have a particular view, Republicans have a different one, and even to the extent that Republicans might be willing to find some solutions that maybe Democrats could agree to, it's not necessarily in the political best interest of Democrats to agree to the half-full kind of approach rather than we want it all.
Mm-hmm. Now, the vote on this King's First Amendment was used by Latino groups to develop. he had a previous amendment, we should mention, that this is the second amendment that the King, Steve King, has sponsored that the House has approved. The previous one, also largely on partisan vote, effectively would end the deportation referrals of the Obama administration granted young immigrants here. This has something to do with the DREAM Act?
The DREAM Act. I can't say the details of that particular act, but it's one of these things where, of course, King has been outspoken on immigration issues, been attacked on his stance on immigration issues. And so this is a combination of things where he's getting certain things done. This was also a criticism of him in the last election where he hadn't gotten anything done, hadn't gotten any amendments or legislation passed. So he can at least point to that. And at least to the extent that, again, he's focusing on a very narrow aspect of the immigration, that this may be something that will perhaps curb some of the criticism or flare it up on the other side.
Now, Latino groups said they would use scorecards to inform Latino voters of members' records on immigration for the coming midterms, also for the 2016 elections. Are Republicans worried about that?
To a certain extent, sure. The Latino-Hispanic population is not as monolithic in its voting as the black population.
But there was a significant difference in the voting patterns we saw in 2012, weren't there?
Sure. And so it's certainly something that they would be aware of, and certainly any candidate who may be on the put in quotes, wrong side of that list or be criticized because of that list would certainly need to have responses for, okay, this is why I voted this way or this is why I voted the other way.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about politics closer to home. Last night, five Republican U.S. Senate candidates squared off in a debate broadcast by KCCI-TV, a 90-minute debate. You watched it, I assume?
I did.
Okay. One of the candidates' last opportunities to get their message out for a wide audience before votes are cast next Tuesday, June 3rd. The candidates, Joni Ernst, Mark Jacobs, Scott Chabon, Sam Clovis, and Matt Whitaker. You tweeted, I saw in reports during the debate, there were no major missteps, no knockout blows. So what were the highlights you saw?
Well, again, it was one of those things where the candidates were fairly cautious. It was interesting to see the response. I followed the Twitter feed and seeing what both the critics on both the left and the right of the various candidates. And some people were saying, look, you need to – this is your last chance. You need to really distinguish yourself from the competitors. And that just didn't seem to be happening, that there were as several people reported, that the candidates tended to resort to their talking points and they didn't want to go after folks, even to the extent that they may have gone after their fellow candidates in advertising or mailers or something of that nature. And I can understand that both as a thing where you don't want to make a mistake in your last big opportunity before the primary. Also, it's different when you kind of go after somebody in an advertisement on television or in a mailer. It's less personal rather than it seems like you're, you know, necessarily attacking someone. We've seen in past debates where if one candidate has gone a little bit too aggressively after another candidate that's on the same stage, that then they get criticized for that.
Mm-hmm. What are the polls saying about these five candidates?
Well, at least the last poll that I saw was the Loras College one, which had Joni Ernst at around 30% and Mark Jacobs down in the teens and Clovis closing in and Whitaker behind, Chabon down at the bottom. It looks like at this point what we can perhaps expect from the primary, the big question will be Ernst will probably have the highest number of votes, but will she get to 35%? What's significant about that 35% is that then she would actually win the primary and become the nominee. If she doesn't get to 35% or anybody else, then it goes to convention. So at the state convention, the delegates to that convention would then make the choice of who their nominee will be for the Senate seat.
Well, a good time to mention that iowapublicradio.org has a voter guide, a 2014 voter guide, where you can listen to and read the candidates' answers, all of the ones that I listed here just a moment ago, to many questions about issues on our election. Just go to iowapublicradio.org to find the 2014 voter guide so you can compare these candidates on the issues if you're going to be voting in the Republican primary come Tuesday. So I'm going back to the debate. If you're not polling well, if Joni Ernst is up in the 30% region and you're back in the teens or the single digits, why not attack? I mean, it's your last chance.
Well, again, it's the kind of a thing where you don't want to be seen as too aggressive, especially if you think that you've got momentum. I know the Clovis campaign has been feeling very good about that they've been moving forward, and they think the momentum is with them, and they would hate to stall that momentum in the last few days of a campaign with a what's perceived as a too aggressive debate. So Clovis was doing the things that he did, sticking with the issues, and in fact had a good follow-up where he was the speaker right after Ernst, where the moderator had asked, well, you know, what is the immigration law? And Joni Ernst didn't have an answer. Basically he said, well, we need to see what those laws are. And Clovis, as the next speaker, spoke right up and said, well, here's the law, and named it and talked about the details. And so that, you know, presented him in a good way. Now, how much that hurt Ernst, probably not a whole lot, but it certainly looked good for Clovis. Whitaker did a good job as well. Shaven had, as usual, a couple of really nice lines. And he was actually the one that was most direct, where he made a comment about the number of votes that, as a state senator, Joni Ernst had missed. And Jacobs, of course, was touting his business. So they all sort of focused on their strong points and really didn't get into why the other candidate maybe is not so great. They always just want to, well, let me talk about me. Let me talk about why I'm the person that you should have, even when the moderator tried to get them to mix it up a little bit.
What differences? You mentioned immigration, but what are the issues that came across as having real differences between this group of candidates when you watched?
Well, that's kind of part of the problem, is that especially in a primary, regardless of the party, you often don't have a lot of major differences on the issues. It tends to be sort of a nuanced thing. And so it's more a matter of things like, as we're seeing in some of the advertisements, where there was a time when Joni Ernst supported a gas tax here in Iowa. Now she's against it. So now are you going to label her as a flip-flopper? In her ads against Mark Jacobs, and these are the two that seem to be going after each other most directly because they seem to be the front runners, where she says, well, he's not really from Texas. And he even addressed that. I said, well, look, I am from Iowa. I grew up here. Yes, I spent much of my life in Texas, but I came home when I had the chance. And so, you know, you get that kind of back and forth talking about background a little bit. You don't see quite as much difference on the issues. One of the ones perhaps that came up in the debate over the farm bill, some people supported it for some reason. Some people didn't, and some people, well, I stand with, you know, Senator Grassley, and that's always a good thing, and renewable fuel standard. And this is where Whitaker sort of distinguished himself a little bit, saying, look, we believe in free markets. He also distinguished himself to a certain extent in terms of the position on the Iraq war and Afghanistan and so forth. And so the candidates kind of had to run down the list as whether they were supported or not supported. And there were some variations there, but, you know, generally not that much.
And finally, the Republican winner of this primary. Perhaps someone will win outright in Tuesday. Perhaps not. It will be decided in convention. In any case, that person will square off against the U.S. Representative Bruce Braley, a 7-year congressman with no opponent in the Democratic primary. Mm-hmm. Any indications about which of these candidates would do better against Braley?
You know, it's kind of a hard thing because, again, they each have their strengths and weaknesses. That certainly Joni Ernst's background, which she's been touting a lot in the primary, would be a good thing for her as a veteran and a legislator, state legislator, and mom, as she always says, and so forth. That's a good biography, so to speak. The question for her would be, how well versed is she on the issues? Well, that's where Clovis is very strong, but there's a possibility that he could be painted as too conservative. He was even asked that in a debate and said, of course not. I'm paraphrasing, but said, no, you know, I stand for these principles. Whitaker, of course, with his own trial experience as a former U.S. attorney for Iowa, has good experience, should be good in terms of the debates that we would see people going head to head. And Jacobs, of course, with the business experience, would be able to talk about the economic side of things, which are going to be important. So each has certain strengths, but each is going to have certain weaknesses, too.
Okay, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, Associate Professor of Political Science. Thanks to you for catching us up on political developments before we head into the weekend. Tim Hagel, thanks.
You're welcome.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, I'm reminded of those old episodes of Perry Mason, I guess, when we have this next conversation. Court reporters. These are the quiet figures in the courtroom. They sit off to the side, making sure that every word of what is said is accurately recorded. And it's estimated, though, that within 10 years, 60% of Iowa's courthouse reporters will be retired. In western Iowa, where there's already a lack of court reporters, that poses a problem, especially here in a state where, until recently, there have been no programs to educate new reporters. DMAC, the Des Moines Area Community College, recently announced that they will be enrolling students in a new program of one of a kind in the state. And Sarah Hyatt joins us now, president of the Iowa Court Reporters Association. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Ben.
Remind us, what do court reporters do?
The official court reporters, the ones that are in the judicial system that sit in the courtroom that you talked about, we record and transcribe what happens in the courtroom. And then we have different fields of court reporting as far as outside, as far as captioners, freelance court reporters, and court reporters.
So a number of different types of reporters. Earlier this week, let's talk about the shortage. Earlier this week, a court reporter from Iowa, Brooke Bettsworth, was quoted in the Sioux City Journal, joked that court reporters that work in her district have to find a replacement before they retire. So how bad is the lack of reporters across the state?
We're not there yet, but we're looking towards the future. The profession as a whole hasn't marketed itself very well in the past few years, partly because the recruiting pool originally started in like secretarial classes where you would take business courses at like a business school or a technical school that had a two-year degree associated with it.
Mm-hmm. But we're getting this program back at DMAC?
Correct.
Tell us about that. When will it start? Do you know?
The start date is August 25th, and they will take over from American Institute of Business. Had the program before. I'm talking with American Institute of Business doing the transition, and they will do a two-year program starting on August 25th.
Mm-hmm. What is the long-term future of court reporting? Specifically, will it always be done by humans? Why?
Well, that's our hope. Humans are trained more appropriately to report the transcripts, the hearings, any type of hearing that needs a verbatim record. We are trained in Iowa, we have to pass a test at 225 words a minute at 97% accuracy.
Wow.
So a machine can't really stop someone, say, I can't hear you, you need to talk slower, everyone talk, you know, one at a time.
Right.
Even with machines in the courtroom, they still propose having a human run the machines. So it seems a bit silly if you're going to have a human in the courtroom to just have that person do the reporting like we've been trained to do.
Okay, thank you for that information, Sarah Hyatt, president of the Iowa Court Reporters Association. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up in the second half of our program, we'll talk with a New York Times reporter who's making a journey with a photographer north on I-35. I think they're in Texas now. We'll be heading up to Iowa. We'll find out what that's about. Marshalltown native actor Toby Huss talks about his new series on AMC that premieres this weekend. You'll want to catch that. Also, toward the end of the program, we remember Maya Angelou. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll be right back.